for that very nice introduction, and thanks to you and Kristen for organizing the workshop and inviting me. As she mentioned, so I was actually an undergraduate here. I was realizing on the plane down, it's like more than a quarter century ago. It's pretty scary. And this is only the second time I've been back to the campus since then, and the other time was also a long time ago, so it was fun to be able to come back. I should also tell you, I didn't realize how much anxiety it was causing for the organizers, but just in case you're worried about it, there are lots of things in this set of slides that look like typos, but they're not typos. They're just unconventional abbreviations. Here is what I'm going to talk about. So this talk is basically going to be focused on a central case or example of the theme of this workshop, which is trade-offs and conflicts of values in health. And I want to talk about a kind of trade-off or conflict of value for health that I think hasn't really got a lot of attention, although I think once you think about it, you'll see that it is one of those, and it should get some attention. So it's actually, the main point is pretty simple. So the talk has really two parts with a little coda. So I'm going to try to set up my question a little bit just to make it clear that I'm not actually asking some things you might think I'm asking, which are worth asking, but not today. And then I'm going to give you a very sort of general pass through my main point, and then I'm going to try to illustrate it with a specific example, which will be the case of education. Okay, so my title question is it permissible to maximize individual health? And I'm going to be trying to argue that the answer to that question is no. But there's lots of different ways to understand that question, so there's lots of different ways to get to the answer no. Some of them, I think, are in one way kind of well-known and in that sense boring, and others are less well known. So I'm going to just try to explain the ways that I'm not talking about it, and then I'll try to explain the way that I am talking about it, and then I'll try to answer it. So the first thing, which actually showed up in a different typo in my title, you might think that the question is really about, is it permissible to maximize aggregate health? So in particular, if you're doing a cost effectiveness analysis, one of the goals, you know, that's facilitated by cost effectiveness analysis is aggregate health, and there are lots of good philosophical and even practical questions about, I guess to start with, whether it's possible to define aggregate health, but then even if it is, or even if there are various definitions, if those are kind of morally acceptable or permissible definitions, and the debate about the Oregon rationing experiment is one famous example of reasons you might think it's not permissible to do that, but I'm not talking about that. You might also, even if you notice that the word individual is in the title and that the question is whether it's permissible to maximize individual health rather than aggregate health, you might also think that one reason you can't maximize individual health is that there are some trade-offs between individual health and population-level health where you can't have both, and in some cases there's a good reason to promote population health. These are really just kind of health versions of standard questions about consequentialism, and is it possible or permissible to kind of sacrifice or run over the individual in the service of various social aims? And again, you could debate about that, and if you think that the answer is sometimes yes, that will be a different way in which it's not permissible to maximize individual health. But I'm not talking about that either. One more thing I'm not talking about. Even if you put consequentialism to one side and you're just looking at the individual and you're taking the sort of individual's claims as in one way sacrosanct, a different reason that people are aware of, but I think not so much in this connection, why it will turn out not to be permissible to maximize individual health is that it's not permissible to spend, you know, the sky or the moon or some unlimited sum of money in health promotion. There is some limit to what's justified to spend on health relative to other goals. Another way to put that point is some form of rationing of healthcare seems pretty clearly not just permissible but required. But if you accept that, that means that there's a kind of further promotion of health that you could achieve, i.e. by spending more than you're allowed to spend. And if you're not allowed to spend that much, then you're not allowed to achieve that further increment of health, which is another way of saying you're not permitted to maximize individual health. Okay, so those are all the ways, interesting though they may be, that I'm not talking about. Here's what I want to talk about. I want to put the debate between sort of consequentialism and the standing of the individual to one side and just assume, again, that we're taking the individual and her claims as sacrosanct. We're not going to have any population-level trade-offs in the promotion of her health. I'm also going to assume that we have some fixed health budget, and just to make life easy on myself, I'm going to say it's the correct fixed health budget, whatever that is. And I want to ask the question, just looking at what's possible to promote by way of promoting individual health with just the resources that you are permitted fully to spend on some individual, is it permissible, as it were, to do everything that you can under that correct budget constraint to maximize that person's health? That's the question. Okay, and the answer that I want to try to explain or argue for is, even still, even with all that, no, you're not permitted to maximize that person's health. So let me just put a few caveats up front, because people always get tripped up on some of these things, and sometimes I just assume that, well, of course, everyone's imagining that we're not worrying about this and that, but maybe it's helpful to say. So maximizing health is not talking about, you know, certainly achieving some outcome. So there are only some things that are under social control that you can do to promote health. Other things, you know, make a difference to health, but you can't do anything about them. In particular, genetics and accidents are two examples. So I'm assuming that we're just focused on promoting health by means that are available and possible to promote health by. I'm also assuming that if you're talking about spending a certain kind of budget share on the individual, there's lots of ways to spend a budget share that aren't necessarily effective or efficient or well-designed. I'm also imagining that we're talking about, you know, within the limits of knowledge, an effective, responsible deployment of those funds. And it's also, I think, true that even if you think of, you know, an equal per capita share of the correct health budget as, you know, a good first approximation of what one individual would be entitled to by way of health spending, in any given point of time, that's not really strictly going to be true, because not everyone falls ill at the same time in the same year, and you're not required to spend on someone who isn't ill, and so that approximation of the target is also rough, but I'm going to never mind about that. See, I'm making things easy for myself left and right. Okay, so my question is, with all those sort of explanations, is it possible or permissible to maximize individual health? And I'm taking it that the kind of common sense or first blush answer is yes, of course. Well, now that you've cleared all that out of the way, why wouldn't you be permitted to maximize health? I think there's also a reading of, for example, the International Human Right to Health, which would give that answer. I put the star there because, you know, on one interpretation, which is probably the plain interpretation, the human right to health actually requires more than that, because it doesn't respect any budget constraint. It just says the highest attainable. But if you read highest attainable as highest attainable under a correct or reasonable budget constraint, then the human right to health would say the answer to my question is clearly yes. But I want to try to argue that the answer is really no. Sorry, getting too excited. So that's where we are. We're in the middle. So now I'm going to try to give you a kind of general explanation in very sort of abstract general terms about why I think the answer to this question is no, and then I'm going to come back and illustrate those structures with the specific case of education. And then at the end I will just very briefly say how you could kind of wrap the same discussion up in the language of rights if you wanted to and what that would look like, but that will be very brief. So here's one way of looking at my question. There are several kind of, I think, understandable, although sometimes controversial, sources of the limits on the permissibility of what you can do to promote health. One may be if there are any morally sanctioned aggregate health trade-offs. I'm just kind of saying what I said before in different words. Another might be if there's some sanctioned constraint on the budget you can spend. And what I want to explore, this is what I think is the kind of not so well-noticed idea, is that if you pay attention to the causal complexity of health production, you will actually find other sources on the permissibility of what you can do to promote health. So just to give it a simple tour, here are some sort of clearly different and I think fairly generally recognized causes of individual health. So personal medical care, kind of traditional health care, narrowly construed, public health measures of various kinds, and you can debate about how you draw the boundary between some of these categories, income, education, workplace organization, and then I say other stuff because you could go on for a while, but I just wanted to give a representative sampling. So nutrition would be another example, although it's harder, I think, to say where in these categories it falls, but it doesn't really matter. And for my purposes, I want to focus on the sort of bottom three examples, which are what people sometimes call examples of social determinants of health. How they got that name, I have no idea, since it seems perfectly reasonable to call any of these things a social determinant of health. But in the literature, social determinants of health kind of exclude by definition healthcare, but also public health. And whether nutrition should count as a social determinant of health, you know, could be debated, but not to much profit, I think. And the main point, or the main feature of social determinants of health for these purposes, is that there are causes of health that actually have at least a dual purpose, in the sense that, so they causally serve the promotion of health, but they also causally serve various other important social goals. And in some cases, like income, you might say, there's really a sort of healthy variety of social goals that they serve. But for the point of the argument, all that's needed is that they serve more than one purpose, more than the purpose of health. So there's the health purpose and there's other purposes, and they may be one or several. Okay. Already, that simple point, I think, opens up the following fairly straightforward space. Namely, if there's more than one goal that these causes are kind of instrumentally efficacious in serving, it's perfectly possible that there will be a conflict in the assignment required of the one and the same cause, depending whether you're talking about serving one goal or the other goal. And for our purposes, obviously the more relevant point is there may be a conflict in the assignment of one and the same cause, depending on whether you're thinking about it as serving the goal of promoting health or serving some other socially important goal. And the last point is, so if there is a conflict in that assignment, and if it turns out that in the sort of all things considered moral assessment of which of these assignments has more moral weight, the answer is not the health assignment, the other assignment, whatever it might be, then you will have quite another, but a perfectly different source of a limit on the permissibility of what you can do to promote health, because you won't be allowed to sort of assign that cause in exactly the way that's necessary to promote health, because you have to choose between that health-maximizing assignment and some other assignment, and according to the hypothesis, the other assignment is actually morally more important. So you can't use the health-promoting one. And if you don't, you will have failed to maximize health. Under this assumption, not only would that be permissible, it would be required. You're required not to maximize health. Okay, so that was the very general tour. You see, it's a pretty simple point, and I just want to try to flesh it out with the example of the social determinant or the cause of health being education. So I think that, and so it's well known, and I will review a few figures, bit of data, but you know, there's a very sort of strong and robust in the sense of found across all kinds of environments and under various variations, correlation between individual educational attainment or level and individual health, and roughly, you know, the more or the better educated you are, the healthier you are. In these sort of areas, it's always a further question, as most of you know better than I do, you know, to what extent is that causal correlation? So I think a lot of people believe, but it also seems very plausible, that in the case of education, you know, at least a good part of that correlation is causal. How much of it is causal? I think it's probably hard to say. And I add that maybe, although maybe not for epidemiologists, but maybe for some people, education is a case where it's more plausible that the social determinant is actually causal. I say that because some people, so Angus Deaton would be one example, are actually skeptical that there is much causality in the sort of equally well-known and maybe even more studied income and health correlation. What do I know? I can't really contradict him. It seems kind of crazy to me to think that it's not at all causal. But anyway, but even he is less skeptical, even not skeptical about the case of education. So I'm using education partly for that reason, and partly because in the case of education, I think the other cause is sort of more clear and it's singular. Having an educated, you know, education as a verb and education as a noun, you get the cause pretty simply and straightforwardly. And furthermore, although I think this is also true for other social determinants, it's worth underlining, I think, that this kind of correlation or likely causal role holds both in developed and in developing countries. And in developing countries, it seems, and there's actually a good explanation of this too, that it's particularly strong in, for the case of women's or women's and girls' education. So the education of women and girls in developing countries is actually a very powerful causal contributor to health, not partly because it's not just their health, but as it were, their children's health, which of course in most cases means at some stage of life, everybody's health. That's why it has such a, I think, greater effect than men's education, even though men's education also has an effect. Okay, so I think now I'm going to show you a few sets of slides just to kind of underline the point. So first give you some American data and then some European data and then some developing country data. This is white mortality rate ratios comparing people who have, in the low group, 0 to 8 years of education against people who have something more than high school, so at least 1 year of college or more. And in this kind of data presentation, 100 is the sort of index mortality rate of the 13 and plus education group. So what you see in either men or women, and the two different color bars are just for different periods of time. So the darker bar is later. It's 1979 to 1989. And actually what's interesting is that as time goes on, the educational correlation with health actually becomes stronger. So just to kind of review the ones that's easiest to see, for the men in the dark bar, the later one, in the youngest age group, there's twice the mortality in the lowest educational group as there is in the highest. And even when you get to the oldest age group, 75 plus, there's still more mortality, not quite 1.5 times, but sort of 1.25 times, something like that. So that's comparing, you know, the lowest educational group to the highest as they've defined them. You can get similar data that takes the middle group compared to the highest. So this is people who have high school education compared to people who have more than high school education. So again, the dark and the non-dark bars are the same time period. And again, 100 is the index mortality rate in the better educated group. So, but just to give you one example, in the youngest group, 25 to 44, you still have 1.5 times the mortality rate for people who have high school versus 1 or more years more than high school. So if you go from the bottom to the top, you get a big gain. But even going from the middle to the top in terms of that simple educational ladder, there's a gain. Okay. In the European case, there's sort of less fine-grained data. They only divided things into two groups. There's basically the high education group and the low education group. And the way they defined that, which is really just a way of trying to get data comparability across their different population pools, is lower sort of primary education or less and secondary education or more. So it's basically, you know, did you make it out of elementary school or not? And really what you need to know, I can just give you the overall figure. There's 33% more mortality in those who did not make it out of primary school compared to those who did. And that's roughly the same across all the different sub-jurisdictions they kind of looked at. There was a little bit of a difference favoring sort of, the inequality was less pronounced in Southern Europe than it was in Northern Europe, but basically 33% more. Okay. So this is just the paper that gives you the source for these next two slides. This is developing countries, 45 countries, looking at now slightly different kind of variable. What's the impact of the mother being in primary school, having a primary school education, as compared to having really no education at all, on the under 5 mortality rate? And just draw your attention to the bottom line. So this was over a kind of 10-year period from the late 80s to the mid-90s. You have a 26% reduction in under 5 mortality for the mother having primary school compared to no primary school. And again, here, unlike the Europeans, we at least have three steps. If you now compare the impact of secondary schooling to primary schooling, so this would be on the top of primary schooling compared to no schooling, you get a further 36% reduction. Okay, again, this is across all the 45 countries they were looking at. So that's some data, but to kind of go from there to the philosophy, I have to tidy it up with some assumptions. So that was just to remind you about the correlation, and I think just to kind of warm up the idea that it's plausible to assume that there is some causal contribution of education to health. So I'm just going to assume that's true. There's some causal contribution of education to individual health. I'm also going to assume something that I don't really know how to prove or even to find data on, although if other people know, that would be great, which is that, so one question is there a causal contribution? A different question, if you're talking about a kind of health system that is operating under a budget constraint, is what's the comparative cost effectiveness of, you know, this health intervention versus that health intervention? If we're looking at education as a cause of health, and from that point of view, education also counts as a health intervention. So one question is, how does education as a health intervention compare to all the other kind of more traditional or standard kinds of health intervention you might make? And the assumption I'm going to make, which again I think is pretty plausible, I don't know if it's more plausible in the developing country case. I think it's probably pretty plausible in both cases, but I'm really just talking off the top of my head, is that if you were to rate the contribution of education, say, one further year of schooling in the same cost effectiveness analysis that you use to rate all your other health interventions, some additional education compared to whatever the default is, we'll come back to the idea of the default, some additional education would rate above the cutoff. That's all I need. So you wouldn't be ruled out from using any education instrument as one of your kind of elements in the health package on the cost effectiveness ground. So it's a genuine cause, and its cost effectiveness is at least good enough that it would put, let's say, in the simplest case, one extra year of education above the health cutoff. Okay. So if that's correct or under those assumptions, it actually follows that in order to maximize an individual's health under the budget constraint, you're required to include in your health package for the health system some additional spending on education. Okay, in the more specific minimal example I gave earlier, you would be required to include one additional year of education in the health package. Okay, and here's a further important point that you'll come back to see the importance of later. I'm actually only assuming that that's true for some individuals in the population. So maybe it's true for everyone, but all I really need is that for some individuals in the population, that's true. So maybe that for some individuals, it wouldn't pass that threshold, and for others it would. But just looking at the ones for whom it does, the point is for them, maximizing their health requires that additional expenditure on education. Okay, so now go back to the general point I was making earlier. It's also possible, and now I'm going to in a minute try to argue not only possible but plausible, that that distribution of education, the one you get by adding on to whatever the background distribution is, the additional spending on education required to maximize health for at least some people, is actually inconsistent with what the principles of what I'll just call vaguely justice in education, namely whatever justice requires about education, just looking at education for its own sake, I'm calling that justice in education. That distribution may well be inconsistent with the one that you would get by adding the additional health-inspired spending on top. So just to give you a sense of that idea, I'm going to just describe, this is, again, just not quite arbitrary, but selected assumptions, scenarios in which you could see that the two can easily come apart. I'm going to give you four scenarios. But first, I'm going to have a drink of water. So here's the first scenario. I don't know why. I think this maybe is the most likely first assumption you'll make, but if it's not, that's fine. So I'm assuming here that what justice and education requires is equal educational provision for everyone. And then the question would be, at what level are you required to provide equal education for everyone in the population? And in this scenario, I'm going to say it's at the high school level. What's required is everyone has to be given education through high school, and then after high school, they're on their own. But it turns out that the sort of further contribution of paying attention to what's necessary to maximize health gives you a result that for some, but not all people in the population, they actually need to be required, provided with another year, say some college. So now some people are going to get some college and everyone else is going to get high school. And there's just a straightforward conflict between, on the one hand, the educational requirement of equality, and on the other hand, the inequality that results. And in this scenario, you see this is one of the dimensions of variation. I'm assuming that the reason that some but not all people are required under the health maximizing goal to get an additional year of college, of education, is that only some people are actually going to benefit in terms of health from an additional year of college. So even though there's a strong causal contribution, I'm assuming it's not uniformly distributed in the population. That's what makes this scenario distinctive. So for some people it's true, but for other people it's not true that that would help. So under the health goal, only some of them are going to be entitled to it. That's scenario one. Scenario two, which maybe you might say is a difference of plausibility as between a developed and a developing country context, the same assumptions except for I've just changed the levels of education. So what justice and education requires is still equal provision, but now what's required is equal provision at the primary school level. You're not required to give everyone secondary school, maybe just because you can't afford it. But that, again, for some people but not all, and again, because of their differential ability to benefit, you are required to spend some secondary education. And again, you get an inequality, which is inconsistent with the requirement of justice and education. Okay, scenario three, just to remind you how many different axes this thing can permute on, same assumptions as scenario two. So equality in education only at the primary level, and maximizing health requires that some but not all get some secondary education. But now the reason being not that there's differential ability to benefit, but that there's differential cost effectiveness in delivering that same ability to benefit. So remember, it's required in order to maximize your health that some additional spending be made on education. Only if both, that would be causally efficacious, so you would actually benefit from it health-wise, but also that it kind of rates above the cutoff in terms of its cost effectiveness. So this is the assumption that maybe even if the ability to benefit doesn't vary across the population, maybe the cost effectiveness of delivering that benefit does vary. And just to give you one simple example, maybe there's a difference between delivering this benefit in rural areas versus urban areas. Okay, that could make the cost effectiveness different, even though the background ability to benefit doesn't differ. Either way, you still get different and inconsistent distributions as between what health requires and what education requires. Okay. Now, last one, in a way, more radical tweak, but just to show you this can go all over the map. Let's assume that what justice in education requires is not equality of educational provision, but differential educational provision, basically targeting more education at children who can benefit from it more. So you can think of this as a kind of educational version of, you know, the famous ambition horribly misrepresented by Rawls, but in its real meaning, careers open to talents. So it's just the more talented students get more education, And that's what's required by justice in education, because on that assumption, justice requires, as we're matching the educational provision with the talent. Okay, you could make any assumption you like about what justice in education requires. I think it's natural to assume it's equality, but this is just to show we don't need that. And then to flip it, what the maximizing of health requires in the distribution of education is actually an equal distribution of education, because now on this assumption there is a kind of uniform ability to benefit in the population. So what you would need is, with the background differential distribution of education, to maximize health, you'd have to top up all the people who got less education under the justice and education dispensation so that they're now, again, equal in education with everyone else. That would maximize health, but again, it would contradict the requirements of justice in education. Okay, so let me stop proliferating scenarios, just give you the general lesson behind all the scenarios. And I think when you see the general lesson in the general form, after having gone through some scenarios and having the background data in mind, I'm hoping you'll think, yeah, I guess that's pretty plausible. So you will get a conflict in what's required of the distribution of education compared to the perspective of justice in education and justice in health unless one of two conditions holds, okay? So either you need it to be true that the distribution in the population of the ability to benefit health-wise and education-wise from a given increment of education is the same, so that the ability to benefit in terms of the health benefit and the education benefit is the same in the population, and that what, as it were, target structural distribution, the two principles require, justice and education, is also the same. So, for example, if both health justice and education justice require equality, and if the distribution of those abilities to benefit is constant and the same for both, then you won't get a conflict. That's one way you could not get a conflict. The second way you could not get a conflict is if the ability to benefit differs for those two benefits, but for some reason there's an exactly inverse requirement in what the principles of justice in education or justice in health require, so that actually the empirical difference is canceled out by the normative difference. In the end, what you need net in each case is still equality. Okay, if either of those conditions holds, then there won't be a conflict between what's required for education. But my claim is the first condition is empirically very implausible, that there would be exactly the same distribution of ability to benefit for these two totally different causal relations. Why would they be exactly the same and exactly the same distribution in the population? It's not impossible, but it would certainly be a giant coincidence. The second condition, I think, you know, has a more plausible empirical assumption, but the moral assumption is very implausible. You need it to be true that for reasons independent of needing to cancel out the background empirical difference, the requirements of the two principles are exactly kind of inverse and mirroring. I mean, if there's a contest, I think this one is even more implausible, although they're both implausible. So if that's right, the main point is there is a conflict in what justice in education and justice in health requires of the distribution of education. Okay, and finally, I don't really have that much to say about this, but we can talk about it in the discussion. I'm assuming that in this case, if there is such a conflict on this kind of core point, that the requirement of justice in education will prevail. So let me just stop there and we can talk about it if you want. But I'm assuming that if there is a conflict like that between education and health, both requirements of justice, the one of justice in education prevails. And if that's right, then you're not permitted to enact the health-maximizing distribution of education. And if you're not permitted to do that, then you're not permitted to maximize health, because it's necessary to maximize health to implement the health-maximizing distribution. Okay, so now I'm basically at the end. I'm just going to wrap the core of that point up in the language of rights. Some people, I'm not one of them, like to discuss everything in the language of rights, and there is a kind of separate literature on conflicts of rights that's different from conflicts of values, so that's why I'm doing it. But so if we assume, which you could debate, that the sort of requirements of justice in education and the requirements of justice in health either are in the first instance expressed in terms of, or in any way entail later for other reasons, that there is such a thing as a right to health and a right to education, okay, then the conflict I've been describing could just be re-described as a conflict between the right to health and the right to education. And if you also assume, which is okay, a more optional point, that rights are to be interpreted rigidly, by which I mean, so if the right to health requires maximizing individual health, then either that's what you're required or permitted to do, or if you're not, then there is no right to health. There's no kind of middle ground. You can't just say, oh, well, the right can be defeated in this, then that, in the other case. So if you make that assumption, you could either say, well, then there's no right to health, because they do conflict and the right to education prevails, or maybe a little bit more precisely, you could say, there's no right to the highest affordable standard of health. That's to say, it's not permissible to do that, but also there's a right to health only if it is permissible to do that, so that there's no right to health. Okay, that's under the rigid interpretation. If you adopt a less rigid or not rigid interpretation, so that there can be a right to health or a right to the highest affordable standard of health, but that right can be defeated under various circumstances without, you know, making the right disappear, I mean, that's all very nice in a way. And if you do that, then you won't, by this method, show that there is no right to health. But it will still be true that it's not permissible to maximize individual health. It'll still be true that maximizing individual health can't be required by the right to health, because that's not permissible and it's defeated. That doesn't show there's no right. There's a right to some other kind of health. But the main point remains the same. So this is also one way of illustrating, I think, a point that I believe more in general, at least in this kind of area. It doesn't really help to talk about the question in terms of a right to health, because whether there is or isn't a right to health doesn't help you decide either whether, for example, it's permissible to maximize health, or if there's a conflict between this right and some other right, which prevails. You have to go elsewhere to decide that. Okay, 36 minutes.
Thank you all. Okay, I see Daniel and then Martin.
Thanks, Gopal. That was great. I couldn't agree. I couldn't agree more. And so I'll ask you to elaborate a little bit with maybe the last 4 minutes that you didn't use in order to, for you to give me more stuff to agree with. And the stuff that I'd be really useful for you to give me stuff with which to agree has to do with the assumption that you made at the very end. You know, so there are certain milieus, both philosophical and practical, in which the assumption is very much sort of either implicitly or explicitly, but usually implicitly denied. So, you know, in the sort of public health as it's understood here, in the public health bureaucracy, the question is, if you could distribute a good in such a way as to increase health with it, why wouldn't you do that? So important is, and you know, when you push people a little bit in it, they will give you something which isn't a completely implausible, sort of proto-philosophical or proto-ethical justification of it, which is that if you distribute more education, for example, or more, you know, as you said, there are other, you used education as an example, but it's sort of, the point carries. If you distribute it in order to maximize health, health is such a sort of important good, and it's sort of such an instrumentally important good in the ability that people have to make efficient and flourishing, enhancing use of other goods, that in a way, it's justified even with respect to other goods that you maximize health in the first instance, if you see what I mean. Such will be the impact on healthy people being able to enjoy other stuff out there. So there's at least a sort of, there's a milieu in which there's at least a sort of proto-argument for the inverse, or the, you know, the contrary assumption to the one that you were making. So do you have anything to add to that?
Sure. So, we could go into this in stages. So let me just flag two assumptions that might separately or in conjunction get the result you're describing. So I know, I agree with you that a lot of people talk that way, although I think it's partly because they haven't really, you know, thought it through very carefully. But so here are two assumptions that would deliver it, both of which I would say are clearly false. So one is just the question, you know, is there a conflict in the kind of distribution you get under the two perspectives? I mean, so it's denied when people say something like, well, you know, because of the further effects of health, if you were just concentrated on maximizing health, everything else would turn out right or the way it was. I mean, I just think that's clearly wrong. It's actually more clearly wrong for education than for something like income. But so being super healthy and living longer doesn't get you any more education in the sense of here. I mean, maybe it gets you more life experience, but it doesn't get you more education. More importantly, I think that the other goal, the other assumption, which I think is more commonly made but just untenable, is so if you assume that health is more important good than anything else, and in a kind of, you know, incomparable order of magnitude, so there's no loss in anything that would make up for a loss in health, then you'll get this. But I'm actually assuming that really either they're on a par or they're very close to on a par, health and education, so that the idea that health trumps education across the board isn't really tenable. And the last thing I would add, so maybe I could say three things to warm up my idea, is that I think it's also important that so there are various ways that you can promote health. You have lots of kind of tools and causal pathways. Education is only one of them. So if you're not allowed to use the maximizing distribution of education, it's true that you will pay some cost in health. I mean, under those assumptions, you won't maximize health anymore. But it's not as if you can't still do lots of other things to promote health. Whereas in the case of education, I'm taking it roughly in this sense, the only thing you can do to promote, you know, education, the noun, is to distribute education, the verb. So not only are the two goods on a par, but the kind of link between the good and the instrument and the education is much tighter than in the case of, and you know, center to the core of the goal than in the case of education and health. So I think between the two, that's why I'm just assuming that if there is that conflict, you'd have to take the side of education.
Okay, thank you for a great talk. I really agree with you, but I'm thinking that your conclusion may be much more obvious, actually, because so one thing you didn't do was to define health, right?
Right.
And we may just have a standard definition of that, like Norman Daniels or something like that, or we may adopt the WHO's definition, which is more close to welfare, actually. But I think in either case, no matter which more general theory of justice we adopt, it would follow that it would not be permissible to maximize individual health, right? Because either there would be a conflict with other values, or in the case that we adopt the definition from WHO and claim that this is our concept of welfare, right? And we adopt like a theory of utilitarianism, it would still not be permissible to maximize individual health. So I think actually at a much more standard level, the conclusions follow no matter how we define health and no matter which general believed theory of justice we actually adopt.
Yeah, so maybe that's true. Let me say a little bit about both of the options you flag. So I guess first of all, yeah, I didn't say much about the definition of health, but for better or worse, I guess I was implicitly assuming that the right definition is just at least something other than the WHO definition. So, I mean, well, because you can put the point this way. If you build everything under the sun into the definition of health, then first of all, you can't have a conflict between that and anything else because there isn't anything else. Everything is in health. And even if that's not quite true, because maybe there are a few things that aren't built into health, with respect to anything that is kind of vacuumed up into the definition of health on the WHO definition, and I certainly agree with you, you could see education as having been, or, you know, the education, the noun, as having been vacuumed up into that. There couldn't be any conflict there. So I was assuming that however health is defined, education is actually going to be a separate good from health at one point. I guess secondly, right, even without that issue of conflict, there's still an issue about permissibility in general, as you mentioned in the case of utilitarianism. But then you're just going back, which isn't bad, because I think this really is an open question, to the thing I was flagging to the side, namely, are you allowed any kind of trade-offs with the aggregate? So that is a real dispute. I was just trying not to do it. But one way you could see what I'm trying to do, which doesn't contradict what you said, is Yeah, the idea that if you're open to the possibility of conflicts and you think that health won't win every conflict it gets into, you're going to get further limitations on the permissibility of what you can do to promote health. That's pretty obvious. I was just trying to illustrate that with a case that I think isn't just a kind of either random or marginal case. It's pretty central, but no more than that.
I agree, and it's also important. But I just think even if we exchange health with welfare, right, it would follow from no theory that we should maximize individual welfare. Even if it's our only value, right, it wouldn't follow that we should maximize individual welfare, because there would either be a conflict in terms of some equality, right, or there would be simply a utilitarian concern. It would not be a matter of maximizing individual welfare, it would be a matter of maximizing the sum, right? So it follows from no theory, even if you exchange it with welfare. So, it's important to show why it's the case, right? But,
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, the only thing I would add is, I guess I'm kind of, in a way, targeting or assuming a natural audience of people who themselves aren't utilitarians or consequentialists. So they are already, even though they realize they have these battles to fight, they're already assuming, well, you know, the individual is in one way sacrosanct. But I'm just saying, even for those people, and even if you don't worry about some of these other things, if you just pay a little bit of attention to the kind of reality of health production, you'll still see that there are lots of other limits in the offing. That's it.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Okay, I have Nick and then Larry, and I'll take more people for the list.
Well, like the previous two commenters, I couldn't agree with you more.
Oh, dear, I didn't do a good job of stirring the pot.
I couldn't agree with your conclusions more, but I would possibly take issue with the first three of your scenarios.
Okay.
Because while I don't disagree with them philosophically, I think they're based on kind of a misreading of the evidence.
Okay.
Because my understanding of, like the evidence that you provided, take the first graph of the rate ratios, the mortality ratios, those were all comparing people with the highest amount of education with everybody else. The implicit assumption is that differences in exposure, education, inequalities, lead to inequalities in an outcome, which is mortality. All we can conclude from that is if we made the exposures equal, implicitly by leveling up, by equalizing education, the outcome would be equal, it would be equality of outcome. So I think that undercuts the evidentiary base for the idea of the first three scenarios, which is people are suggesting that we should have unequal distribution of education. We should identify the individuals who will need more and less education in order to make up for the ill health balance. I think the implicit assumption is that this always leads to an equalization of exposure, both for methodological reasons, but also, frankly, for implicit political reasons. That's all.
Sure. So those are good points. Let me say two things about that. So first of all, there is a difference that I'm just going to flag here between the first two scenarios and the third, which I have to do it backwards to get the highlight to show up by disappearing, which is that in the third scenario, the basis for the differential required distribution is a difference not in ability to benefit, but in the cost effectiveness of delivering that benefit. I think what you're talking about is really the first two scenarios where I'm assuming that there's a differential underlying ability to benefit. That's the first point. Second point, so I entirely agree with you, and I didn't really mean to be claiming, but maybe it would be helpful to make this clear, that the evidence I showed, even if we assume that it's got a substantial causal component, is not in any way evidence for this assumption. But it's not evidence against it either. That's the second point. Because that evidence is all kind of group or population level evidence, which is how often the evidence is presented. That just doesn't tell you one way or the other if there's any difference in the underlying kind of, you know, subpopulation. All I'm saying is, just built into the scenario, it's plausible to assume that there is that difference. And I'm only saying, here's my claim. It's plausible to assume that. I don't know if there's evidence for it, and I certainly don't think that what I showed before is evidence for it. That's just neutral.
In many ways, my question follows up on Martin's, but in a kind of spirit of compromise, so I too, I don't think I have any objections to what you said, though my initial ear wonders about the assumption that there's justice in these distinct fields in the way you describe. So my inclination is to think it's a mistake almost always to say we have an independent view of what justice in health requires, and an independent view of what justice in education requires, and an independent view of what justice in something else requires. And then these could conflict. If they do conflict, the structure of your argument goes through. My sense of justice, the way I think about it, is it wouldn't be so bad if someone had more of one of those things, if it was counterbalanced by less of something else and it all evened out in the whole thing, that we don't need equality of education and equality of health and equality of income all separately. You might want equality of what matters most, which gives weight to each of those things. So the way your argument proceeds is if we had independent conceptions of justice, then it can trade off in this way, and then we shouldn't expect to maximize. And I think that works, but some people are going to have an ear that says, but why should we think that? Having said that, I mean, I think you could make the kind of claim you want to make if you want to just distinguish a little bit between social justice and natural justice, the topics we were talking about a little bit yesterday, where it is more plausible to think that there's a standard of social justice that would require that the state provide equal, you know, education, or that the state provide something else, though we recognize that when the state does that, that doesn't guarantee natural justice, the kind many of us would care about. But then if, so you can still make that argument just couching in the terms of social justice, friendly amendment. But then in terms of natural justice, Martin's point, I think, comes crashing to the fore, which is that if you talk about natural justice, you straightforwardly get to the issue of there's no reason to expect that maximizing individual health would result in a just outcome, even if one thought health was the only thing that mattered. Because if you thought equality of health mattered, maximizing individual health, as long as that doesn't lend everyone to be exactly equally healthy, which is not likely to, might be unjust. So. And if you think in natural justice that there are other competing values, then there might be very good reasons not to always be seeking to maximize individual health, because in doing so, there might be people who deserve to fare less well, who are getting more than they should when you maximize their individual health, particularly given everything else that's going on elsewhere in terms of income and education and so on and so forth. So I agree the conclusion is either way, whether you're focusing on the natural or the social, there's no reason to be maximizing health, to think that that would have a carry. I agree with that. I would just slightly couch your presentation a little bit differently for those of us who think that. Okay. So.
Yeah, so let me, I think there are three things I want to pick up, and who knows if I will think of a further one at the end. So the first point, let me take them out of order. So maybe it helps to say in those kind of, in helpful terms. Yeah, I'm just assuming that this is a discussion about what you're calling social justice. So it is focused on what, in a way, justice is requiring on in the way of state or society-wide provision. It's not the different question of, yeah, how do we just kind of evaluate different kind of outcomes or states that we, you know, states of affairs that we find. So that's right. And I agree that if you were talking about natural justice, there would be some further discussion to have. Second point, so I think the first, I mean, the way to introduce it is to say, so the organization of the discussion, I think, in the first instance, is just responding to a striking but possibly objectionable feature of the literature, both in kind of philosophy and also in kind of health or public health, namely that people kind of talk and write in what you might call the kind of mode of silo thinking, right? So they're just talking about health, just focused on that, and then they're not denying that there are other things, but they're just doing them one at a time. So part of the point is to say, well, even if you're staying within the silo, and you're looking at the kind of some realistic basis of what's required to deliver what you're aiming at, and you accept that there are other things, even though you're not always thinking about them, you'll find limits that you didn't think you'd find. If you kind of reject the silo thinking and try to say, well, look, our analysis should be operating at the kind of whatever across the board level from the beginning. I mean, there's a case to be made for that, although I guess a different way of saying the first thing is you don't see it very often. To put it in the language of rights, I mean, that would be like saying, you know, individuals have rights, but their rights aren't to kind of specific things. They're like rights to well-being, right? If you think in terms of a right to well-being, just kind of piggybacks, as you're saying, on what Martin was saying, yeah, a whole class of conflicts will, in a way, disappear. That's true. And then the issue will be more starkly focused on this kind of, to put it crudely, consequentialism or not question, also true. But yeah, maybe it looks more obvious if you're thinking like that, right? Even if you're not looking at the consequentialism question, there's no particular reason to expect that to deliver what's required on the way of well-being, what you have to do is maximize one of its components, namely health.
I feel like I want to jump in, but I'll refrain. Colin, Francoise, and Jürgen, and I think that's going to be it.
I don't know if you saw, she had her hand up.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, okay.
Well, she has the mic in her hand, even.
Sorry.
Then I'll defer to the...
No, I will compress my answers. We'll fit them all in.
I just don't know when she put her hand out.
Before me.
Okay, then.
Before Gopal
then.
Good point. It will be quick. I think it was your talk was a quite useful articulation that, and sometimes I want to scream when I go to the public health social determinants practitioner get together, because then sometimes like health trumps everything and we do everything to make people healthy kind of slogan. So that's great, but when I think about the current evidence of where we're at in terms of the social inequality in health, some of the data you show, where do you see the usefulness of your argument? The reason why I'm saying is that a lot of evidence of the education and health difference, education is usually like, you know, categories are the less than high school, some high, more high school, above high school. So in that way, that then even we are talking about around high school, and then there we still see the differences, and then we think it's problem. So it looks like where we are at right now in terms of people's health, empirically, that suggests that then we are even not reaching to this point to discuss that then. Should we do this intervention because it might be not good? It's good for health, but not for the education justice. If we are just done even before that. There's so much work to do. And so I've not seen any intervention that then some country tries to implement that then everybody should go to college so that then they become healthy. And then when that kind of intervention is in reality, I think your argument is very good and the people should be discussing it. But in a, where do you see the usefulness of your the proposal?
Yeah, so a good question. Sadly for me, I can give you a very short answer. So I don't think there is any immediate practical upshot. I mean, one way of putting it would be to say, I think you can make one step, one stronger step. I think, you know, the social determinants literature on education, for example, itself doesn't have a practical upshot, because, just to explain, so in my case, in order for there to be a practical upshot, you'd have to be in a position to know, you know, where the differential ability to benefit from education, you know, what that sub-distribution looks like, so you know what to target. If you don't know that, you don't have any basis for proceeding. So that's why I say this has no immediate, I'm denying that, whatever, but there's no practical upshot. But even earlier, there's no practical upshot because, so we know that there is this strong correlation between education and health, and I think there's good grounds for assuming that at least a certain amount of it is causal. But I think even to proceed on that evidence, you'd have to have a better grip on how much of it and which bit of it was causal to kind of license some policy. So I think the kind of not there yet for policy point goes even further back.
Without that evidence, just on differential ability to benefit, that's not just education, that's for everything. So like a smoking cessation and, you know, well-educated, resourceful people pick up right away. And it, people, it's the same intervention, it just doesn't go through. So that point is also true for many things. And then even though we don't know, we just don't do it. So.
Right. No, I realize that. So I think across the board, both for that and for the points I was making, education is just an illustration. I mean, I think anytime you've got the dual purpose, you could run the whole show.
So I guess I, like others, agree with the principal conclusion. However, I'm interested in the robustness of scope of the finding. So in your scenarios, the conflict all depended on the adoption of an egalitarian standard, pretty much an egalitarian standard of, you have one non-egalitarian, but here's a different conception of education justice, one which I think regrettably is now quite popular amongst some, and I wonder if the conflict would be less, more easily, those conditions, the feeding conditions, would be more easily met. That is a sufficientarian conception of educational justice, right? And let's just say, for the sake of argument, a relatively low subsidiarian stance, right? In that case, it's not quite so obvious that the conflict would emerge, right? Because that you devoted more resources to some or others would not defeat the background conception of educational justice. So I guess I want to know whether you think, I mean, since I'm an egalitarian about things in general and egalitarian about justice, I'm not really too upset about this, but I want to know whether you think that it's just irrespective, more or less, of your conception of educational justice, you'll have this conflict, or whether it's restricted in scope to a family of, say, reasonably egalitarian or...
Yeah, good point. So I'll give you two quick answers, then we can talk more. Other people have don't have questions. So first, it's not meant to be restricted to a family. So it's meant to be a general point. So if there are counterexamples that arise from looking at other sorts of theories of justice, that's good for the discussion and bad for me. I think it makes a huge difference whether you're talking, sorry to compound jargon, but about kind of egalitarian sufficientarianism or some other kind. The sufficientarianism point, the bit about putting the level low, if anything, makes the case easier. The lower you put the level, if it's an egalitarian level, the more likely it is that there will be benefit above the level, and then if it's not uniform, it'll be for some and not others. If it's not egalitarian sufficientarianism, it's sort of like a funkier version of this. I think it would be more complicated, but I think I could still run the point. I'd have to hear more about what the structure of the non-egalitarian sufficientarianism is.
I think the question I have sort of follows on because it's looking at the same pressure point, if you will. But I was coming at it from the concept of restorative justice. And duties of reparation, and thinking about justice and education, perhaps in a Canadian context, looking at Aboriginal peoples, and imagining a scenario whereby my understanding of justice and education would actually require something differential, paying attention to particular needs there. And then I'm wondering how that, I'm just asking you to elaborate, how would that play out in terms of how you'd understand the next part, the maximizing health for each? Does that then stay within the domain of Aboriginal peoples, or is that going to apply across the population? So we've got a differential commitment in justice with respect to all Canadians, and we're going to privilege a subsection of the community. And then when we get to the maximizing health, when we have discrete health issues within the population, do you only answer it for that population, or does your each now go back to all Canadians, and how does it play out? So it's really just a question of if we change your starting assumption, and it is differential, but really grounded in this commitment to reparation in some sense.
Yeah, so I think that just kind of complicates the story, but you just tell the story in more complicated fashion. So you're saying something sort of like, well, so far as the distribution required by justice and education goes, we actually have to divide the population in this version two groups, Native Canadians and everybody else. And there's one kind of principle for Native Canadians for education and another principle for the other people. So here the question would just be, taking the groups one at a time, is it true that...
So taking them one at a time when you get to the maximizing health?
Yes, taking them one at a time with respect to health. So for Native Canadians, is it true that you can get a further health benefit by giving them even more than they are entitled to individually under the reparation, and then back to the non-Native Canadians, if we're assuming that's equality, same question.
Yeah, but that's, I guess that's where I'm wanting to pull apart, so that your justice claim
yes.
is about all Canadians, and it's going to differentially play out for Aboriginal peoples, and then your health claim is about all Canadians. So I want both of the claims to be about all Canadians, but it's going to have a different effect because you're not committed to an egalitarian understanding of your distribution of your educational benefit. So
the justice and health claim is understood as
all Canadians, and for that you don't differentiate, but you can still ask for any given subgroup, how does the principle that applies to everyone apply in particular to them? The division in terms of the principles of education was given by you as part of the example, so then it's true you don't have one principle for everyone, but that was the complication in the case, so I was just taking it.
Jürgen is wanting to waive his right, but I think we still have a bit of time because we started a bit late. So if you want.
I had the rudimentary version of common.
Oh, great. Okay.
There's a reason why I waived the right.
Okay, so no final comments. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.